Good evening. You're listening to The Interchange on KSPC 88.7 FM Claremont. My name is Anne Kirkpatrick. Tonight on The Interchange, Greta Jong speaks with poet and student Maureen Page as part of KSPC's poetry program, and Maureen selects a few poems to share. Then, Maddie Williams interviews Adam Pearson of the environmental podcast Green Grid Radio. In our second half hour, Warren Sethcheck and Davis Saul discuss the science and spirit of animals on Reality Check. You can contact The Interchange during the show or at any time. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at username interchange887 or email us at publicaffairs@kspc.org with questions, comments, or suggestions. Tonight, we begin with the news. Los Angeles was stunned this week by news of a shooting attack at LA International Airport. The gunman, 23-year-old Paul Ciancia of New Jersey, is under guard at the hospital and has been charged with murder by federal investigators. Ciancia insists he was acting alone when he opened fire in LAX's Terminal 3, wounding two Transportation Security Administration officers and a civilian passenger, and killing a third TSA officer. Travel through LAX was disrupted the rest of the day. The FBI is currently investigating why Ciancia would target TSA officers in this violent attack. Two French journalists working for Radio France International were found murdered yesterday in Mali. The pair was interviewing separatist Tuareg groups in West African nation, which has recently experienced French military intervention in response to the presence of Al-Qaeda groups in Mali. It is not yet clear what person or persons are responsible for the murder of the two journalists, Ghislaine Dupont and Claude Verlon. Prisca Jeptu and Jeffrey Mutai won the New York City Marathon today, with respective times of 2 hours, 25 minutes, and 7 seconds for the women's race, and 2 hours, 8 minutes, 24 seconds for the men's race. This was the first time the marathon had been run in New York since 2011. Last year, Hurricane Sandy caused the race to be canceled. Security at the 2013 New York Marathon was tightened in light of the bombing at the Boston Marathon earlier this year. Stay tuned here on The Interchange for KSPC's poetry program.
Hi, this is Greta with KSPC 88.7's poetry program. Our featured poet this week is Maureen Page, a sophomore from Scripps. Hi, Maureen. How are you today?
Hi, I'm doing well.
Thank you so much for coming in. Could you read some poems for us?
Of course. Thank you for having me. The mountains who bleed of poppies are neither dead nor alive. They grow yet have no purpose of growth. They crumble yet do not pass away. Seasons do not overstay their welcome. They disappear and come again, like a forgotten poem or an old lover. But the mountains prolong their unborn visit as the sunset searches for new wrinkles upon their weathered faces, sinking slowly, only to rise again. A wise owl with wide eyes weaves warmth from the waning moon, cloaked in the presence of absence. She is still, silently sinking into the darkness, like a leaf who allows the water into her pores patiently and without force or intention. Thank you. peeled the layers of darkness into the many shades of black. But what the owl is searching for cannot be found. A sense of peace washes over the silent trees, cleansing the air of her hurried worry and the leftover buzz of bumblebees. She tenderly dances, as if the dandelions were embers, eyes glazed with the dreams of her romances. She knows love will end, yet unremembers. A ripple in existence, pure. Time consumes her slowly with silent slips. From her opened hand, petals spill their soul. The sun descends, a yolk from parted lips. Get tangled in combed trees. She has dissolved, but her love songs remain, stuck to the wings of hurried honeybees.
Thank you so much for reading those poems for us. Could I ask you some more questions about your writing and things like that?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. First of all, what got you into poetry? Like, when did you start? How did you decide on writing poetry?
Well, initially it was because my friend dragged me to a poetry club meeting, and I was kind of against it. I thought it was just kind of a girly thing to do. But I got really into it. Throughout high school, I was in the poetry club, but I definitely focused more on raps. So I did a rap for the talent show about being a woman in the rap world. So I guess lately I've transitioned more into poetry from raps, but I think there's an element of that that still remains in my poetry.
Okay, that's really cool. For your raps, I mean, do you still write raps, or have they sort of fused or shifted over, would you say?
I still write raps, but I don't know if someone, like a professional rapper, would classify them as raps because they're more spoken word. I think they're different in that a lot of raps oftentimes have a lot of negative energy. Mine end up being a lot more positive, I think, and typically have more imagery and are also much shorter than a normal rap would be.
I see. When you say you have a lot of imagery, I guess I'll just ask, what sort of topics do you focus on? In the few poems you've read for us, they're very image heavy, which is a good thing, I think, and they're very evocative, they're very vivid. So do you do that on purpose, or do you particularly focus on any topic when you write poems, or raps for that matter?
Typically when I write poetry, I focus a lot on nature. Obviously, I think I made two bee references. I love bees, but I use nature a lot just because oftentimes when I write poetry, I'll write it when I go backpacking or something like that. And I don't know, I just think that nature is just the world's greatest source of inspiration. So I think I draw a lot from that.
Okay, great. Is that what inspires you most to write? What about some other things that inspire you?
Definitely nature, also certain songs, the feelings that they evoke. You know, I think even paintings, like sometimes I'll go to a museum and I'll just look at some painting by Monet or something and just stop and sit down and write poetry because there's just something about it that just speaks to me. I don't know.
That's awesome. So you said a lot of the time music inspires you. Is that usually the same music you choose to pair with your poems?
Not always. Sometimes music will inspire me, like, for instance, a line from a song, something like that. Although typically it is the same ones that I pair with my poems, because it's really hard to be both producing words and taking them in at the same time, I think. Mm-hmm. So I generally drift towards songs that are slower, that are simpler, just, you know, piano music or harp music, so that there is a source of inspiration, but not so much inspiration that I get distracted by the other form of art that I'm recording over.
Yeah, totally. So how do you choose the music you read to? It almost sounds like it chooses you, as cliched as that might sound. It's less that you choose it and more that you are inspired by it and simply go along with it.
Yeah, I would say that it's definitely more, you know, I'll just listen to, you know, I'll put my iPod onto, you know, piano music or orchestral music or something like that, and I'll just write, and then I'll sometimes listen and nothing will come, and then I'll listen to a different one and all of a sudden, oh, I, you know, just get a certain vibe from this, and then I'll start writing. And
okay, and could we talk about your music choices for the poems that you read today?
Yeah, so the one about the owl, also just about that song, that was a song that I wrote for my friend Anna, and she's a sophomore at CMC. And that was interesting. That one, I wrote the poem first and chose the song later. I chose the song just because it's basically my favorite, one of my favorite songs. Just, I don't know, when there's a good recording of it, it's just really peaceful. And so I thought it was a good pairing for the song. For the other one, that was one where the song was what inspired me. And that one was actually, that was the sonnet, the garden sonnet, with harp music. And the harp music was played by my mom. She is a harpist in Ashland.
Oh, that's wonderful. Are there particular times or places when or where you write? I know you mentioned you tend to write, I guess, outside or when you're hiking and things like that. But are there any, do you have like a set schedule for writing, or is it just when inspiration strikes?
No, it's very unscheduled. I feel like at times maybe I'll go through a dry spell and I'll think, oh, I need to write poetry. I'm not writing anything. But I just feel like you can't force it. So, yeah, all times of the day and night, all places, sometimes very bizarre places like bus stops and awkward train rides.
Nice. So obviously these three poems are a small sample of what you have.
Mm-hmm.
So could you talk a little bit more about the other poems you have, or the other the raps you've written, or mm-hmm. sort of the spoken word things you've done, like the topics and what inspired yeah. you to do some of those?
Well, for one thing, I think with raps, oftentimes there's an attempt to have a deeper social message. So when I do write raps, oftentimes it's either about environmental issues or it is about women's rights. So rape or about the destruction of the environment, problems with agriculture specifically. But and when I write poetry, I think I focus more just on nature, as I said. Try and use a lot of imagery because I think it really allows you to just sort of close your eyes and listen and sort of add a new layer to what you're feeling in the poem.
Great. Do you have any tips for aspiring poets or, you know, people who are kind of unsure what to write about, things like that?
I would say the best tip is just to write and write often. When I first started in high school, I can say with certainty that my raps were, and both my raps and my poetry were very, very poor. And I would read them and I would never read them to anyone else because I was just embarrassed of them. But as time progressed, and also as I started reading them to people and they said, oh, I liked this element of it, or you should expand on this, not only did my confidence grow, but my talent also grew. Also reading other poets, I think, helps a lot because they can help offer you inspiration, tips, those kind of things. Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned that you read some of your poems to other people, and you have a wonderful speaking and reading voice. So was that sort of just a thing that came, or you developed that, or through like reading poems for other people, did that develop?
Well, I think part of it was reading for other people. So we would read poems in poetry club to each other. And I performed once at an art gallery. But part of it was also that I was on the debate team in high school. So I definitely gained a lot of experience from that, reading, speaking in front of people, and, you know, maintaining a calm and collected voice.
Oh, well, you are certainly successful. Great. Okay. Thank you so much for sitting in for this interview and talking with us. And thank you so much for reading your poetry.
Yeah. Again, thank you for having me. Yeah. It was a pleasure.
It was a pleasure having you. This has been Greta with KSPC 88.7's poetry program. Our featured poet was Maureen Page, a sophomore from Scripps. KSPC Poetry airs every 2 weeks on The Interchange, starting at 6 p.m. Thanks for listening, and see you in 2 weeks.
Next on The Interchange, Maddie Williams interviews Adam Pearson of environmental podcast Green Grid Radio.
Adam Pearson, you're the founder, the engineer, and the producer of Green Grid Radio, which airs weekly on KZSU Stanford. That's 90.1 FM. So you started the project in 2012 as a grad student. Can you talk to me about what inspired you to start Green Grid Radio?
Yeah, sure. The previous summer summer of 2012, I spent in Washington, D.C. working at the National Audubon Society, which is an environmental NGO. And I was working on energy policy related to wind and... one day I was on a phone call with someone who was, you know, universally opposed to all wind energy. And I was a little bit surprised because to me and in my schooling, I had spent a lot of time learning about renewable energy, environmental policies, and so on. And it just seemed so obvious to me or sort of natural that it would be something that as a country we would want to pursue. And it was, I was just really taken aback when this woman told me one day, yeah, I think we'd be better off if we got rid of all the wind turbines and said replace the electricity generation with natural gas plants. And natural gas, of course, releases a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And to me, it was just kind of like this befuddling moment where it was like, okay, you're suggesting that the global ecosystem will be better off by polluting more? I don't really understand that. So it forced me to realize that there's a lot of issues that we have as a country, as a science community, especially in communicating some of the more modern research ideas, some of the more modern science that we know to the everyday person. And then I thought, okay, I've been a college radio DJ at KZSU for 4 years. I'm a graduate student at Stanford, so I have access to a lot of these researchers. Let's try to merge these two interests and do something meaningful, make environmental topics relevant to people and science accessible.
So you started Green Grid Radio after this person in Washington, D.C., came up to you and said, we should all be using natural gas, which you basically said, that's ridiculous. We need to be living sustainably. After 3 years of Green Grid Radio, how has the project changed and grown?
It was just last year, last September, that it started. So it's only been 1 year, but we've churned out a lot of episodes. That's probably, I think that's a point of learning for sure. I don't think we're going to be doing that nearly as much anymore. The show started off as reporting, simply trying to touch a lot of scientific topics. So we would have long-form interviews with researchers or professors, people talking about all sorts of really high-level technical garbage that I realized and my team realized was like not relevant to the average person. So we pivoted and changed the focus from instead of reporting every week and having these long-form interviews, we decided to move into something more relevant and something more emotionally significant to people, and we've moved into environmental storytelling as a result. And that change probably happened around January or February, probably about halfway through the school year. And so the end of season two and the beginning of season three really took on a different tone and a different style. And the production has certainly slowed as a result, because these episodes are much more time intensive. They're not something we can throw together in the studio at the last minute, just bring in a guest and sit around and talk for 20 minutes to fill the time. It's not a live program anymore. It's a very time intensive, highly edited, highly polished piece of edited composition. It's a different, it's certainly a different form. And so that's where we are today. And it's kind of, this question's probably coming. What are you doing in Berlin, and how is the show continuing? My team and I are working remotely, I guess, and we're going to be continuing in producing episodes. We're still producing episodes. It's just the pace at which they're going to come out will be slower. So we have an upcoming season, a production season that's in the works, and we're really looking forward to also collaborating with new entities and organizations.
So the range of topics that your show covers is very diverse. You explore a lot of themes related to environmental sustainability, including politics, economics, social issues. You've run some really interesting stories about America's problem with food waste, about the sustainability of the fishing industry, which I thought was a really interesting story. How can you talk to me about how you come up with the ideas for your shows?
Yeah, it's the most fun part. This is where the most rigor comes in, and it's different than typical scientific rigor that I was used to. It's a different kind of rigor. The rigor is instead my team and I, there's five core members. We sit in front of a whiteboard and we pitch to each other. We tell each other what environmental topics have been really lodged in your mind lately. What is it about this recent thing that's happening somewhere that's super interesting or fascinating. So, for example, one of our producers, Diane Wu, came to me and said, you know, I've really always been interested in finding out where a soda can would go if you put it in the trash can or something and you didn't put it in the recycling bin. Where does it go? I think starting from a story or starting from something that is maybe a common everyday thing that a lot of people think about. Yeah, well, have we ever thought about where our iPhone batteries come from? And then we launch into maybe some background on the mining industry or the rare earth metals or so on. Yeah, our criteria are pretty loose, but it's really about, yeah, that's a really good idea. And if it passes the test among the rest of the team, then we pursue it pretty much.
So I know that you were recently honored by the Clinton Global Initiative. Your team went to Washington, D.C. Talk to me a little bit about how that experience was and how it felt to be honored by such a prestigious award.
Yeah, it was really an interesting experience. There were a lot of amazing people there. It's really made me grateful that there are a lot of people out there fighting really hard. And these aren't people who are funded by big corporations. They're not like projects coming out of a lot of capital. They're projects that are started by people who are starting from the grassroots, starting from the micro scale and trying to build these projects into major initiatives. So in a way, it was just really, it's really positive to see that there are people out there who are making a difference in the world. I think in terms of like what it meant for us, I think it was our main mission. It didn't really further that. So it was kind of like a nice pat ourselves on the back moment, but, and let's see what we can learn from the experience and really apply the lessons learned from some of these other organizations to our own organization and our own initiative and just keep moving forward because we really want to be reaching more and more people.
So this is my last question for you. You just mentioned how important it is for Green Grid to help listeners engage with the environment on sort of a DIY level. Can you just tell me, like, what was maybe one of your favorite stories that you've done or a special moment that really captured the essence of why you started Green Grid Radio?
That's a great question. I love the question. All about what we're about, which is telling stories, right? I think the one that jumps out to me now is probably our food waste episode that we did. Diane Wu was the lead producer on that one, and I helped her with the fun part for me, which is the music. but I also helped with some of the editing and other production parts. I would say it's really changed my the way I think about things a lot. I learned so much. For example, Diane really did her research and just the story or the topic just lodged in her brain. She found out that there are some websites that can help individuals decide if expired food is actually still good to eat. And this is like mind-blowing to me because for my whole life, my parents and everyone I know, they look at the, oh, Best Buy October 22nd. Okay, that's a week old. But in reality, there's no regulation on that. That's mostly done by the manufacturers so that they don't get sued. So basically every Best Buy date on food product is off to varying degrees. And it depends on the company, it depends on a lot of things, but it depends on the type of food, of course. But it just like blew my mind. She had some great stories. One story I'll share because it's so memorable for me. There's this girl, a Stanford student, who was studying abroad in Australia, and she is like this super waste warrior person. I don't know how to describe it other than that. And she was at a restaurant with her peers one night. She looked over at the table next door, next to their table, and saw there was this big, like, heaping mountain of chocolate fondue that some people didn't really touch, and they had just left and paid the bill or whatever. And this girl, Nicole, was gazing at it, and she was thinking about waste all the time, like, this is so disgraceful. But she was in this social setting where it would have been like really taboo. She like, went over and grabbed a chocolate fondue mountain off of another table. But she ended up deciding to do it. And all the peers that she was sitting with looked at her kind of funny when she brought it back. And she said it was like a really tense moment. But then as soon as she started digging in, one other person joined her. And then the rest of them were just sort of like, yeah, that's crazy that that's like they would throw that away or whatever. And so I think the story shows a really positive message, which is that, yeah, take a risk. Do something for the environment and talk about it. It's not go and pronounce it to the world. It's show people how you live or how you make environmental choices on a day-to-day basis. And if they want to talk about it, they want to talk about it, and you can share and you can have the conversation. But if they don't want to talk about it, you don't push it on them. So I think that this is a great example of how a discussion started from something that our society doesn't normally, isn't the most common thing in our society, let's say. So that's one of the great moments, I think, in our show's history.
Well, Adam, your show definitely helps someone like me. I'm a little bit environmentally disconnected, but you really bring those issues to me in a way that's really creative and interesting. And it inspires me to make little changes to be more sustainable in a way that's, you know, it's not hard. It's creative. It can be fun. And it can really open up your horizons, I think, also to, you know, what's going on in the world around you. So I've really enjoyed learning about Green Grid Radio, doing my research for this story. And I thank you so much for talking to me. Thank you for answering my questions.
Yeah, no, well, thank you. And I'll just say that, I mean, on a, I guess, a more abstract level, it's, I think everyone on our team, we have such a great bond about people, encouraging people to take a step outside of their comfort zone, I guess. And that's not just an environmental ideal. It's about living life. It's about enjoying life and trying something new.
You just heard an interview with Adam Pearson of Green Grid Radio by Maddie Williams here on The Interchange. Stay tuned for Reality Check with Warren Sethcheck and Davis Saul.
On the highway, a truck needs more time to stop than a car. So when you pull in front of a truck, make sure there's enough room behind you, because there is no room on top of you. A public service message from the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration.
I am Warren Sefcek.
And I'm Davis Saul.
And we are back for another week, incredibly. And it's good to be back.
We made it.
So today on the show, we are going to be talking about, well, we've actually kind of had a difficult time characterizing exactly what we're talking about. Mm. The focus is animals, and by animals we mean non-human animals, let's say. And I guess maybe the way I kind of think about it is the non-human animal experience and kind of what's going on in their mind, maybe, and what that says about us when we try and understand that and how we can relate to them, maybe.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an adequate way of describing it.
Yeah. It's kind of long-winded, but that's sort of what we're doing. Obviously, before that, we need to do our disclaimer. Any opinions that we express here are ours and ours alone. Don't represent Pomona College, KSPC, the Board of Trustees, anyone who might want us here. They're glad we have our opinions, but they don't necessarily agree with them. We'd also like to thank our wonderful sound engineer, Ann Kirkpatrick, Erica Tyrone, the head of KSPC, all the KSPC staff for having us, and of course our lovely parents, as always.
Yes. And all of our families, including my sister.
Oh, true. I forget your sister. I have a sister, too. I'd like to thank her. I don't know if she's listening. I have a brother as well. So we'll thank him, too. Although he's not, I wouldn't say, as directly related to me being here as my parents. But
yes,
still important in shaping who I am. So I guess I have to thank him for that. And if you want to email us once again, or not once again, if you want to email us, we have an email address. We'd love to hear from you. We can't take calls, unfortunately. So if you want to get in contact with us, our email address is kspcrealitycheck@gmail.com. That is kspcrealitycheck@gmail.com. So send us an email. Let us know how we're doing. ideas for this show, the next show, any show after this, if we're still here, which hopefully we will be, just send us a quick email and let us know. But that being said, the topic at hand is the animal experience and what's going on in the animal head. And last time we ended with a story about my late great praying mantis and how it caught some food, this live cricket. The cricket was squirming, and we used that to talk about pain, and we used that to talk about suffering, mm-hmm. and how, you know, the cricket might definitely be in pain or might obviously be in pain or might obviously be feeling something that it doesn't want to be feeling, but can we call that suffering? Mm-hmm. And I think sort of a natural place to go from there is, okay, well, if it can't suffer, if it can't do this thing we call suffering, then there seems to be some sort of distinction between the human mind or the human experience and the cricket's experience. Mm-hmm. And I think part of what we're trying to get at today and understand today is, where exactly is that line?
Mm-hmm. And is that a line,
right,
that we want to draw?
Or should be drawn or even exist?
Right. And what if that line is something that we want to draw, what is the purpose of drawing that line? And maybe what is the purpose of doing studies, scientific or spiritual, that sort of express the way that line is not so concrete or not so fixed as we might normally perceive it to be?
Right. And I think we're realizing that. And then we haven't gotten too far into it, but I think that we are realizing, for example, research on chimpanzees, the federal government has drastically sanctioned that in the United States. What's interesting is they haven't stopped it, but they've drastically reduced it, which says to me that we're kind of thinking, well, chimps are not something that we should be messing with, you know? So it'll be interesting to see where that goes. But in doing my research in terms of the scientific aspect of understanding animal minds, that's not something new to science. It seems that we're very interested in categorizing what animals can and cannot do. Mm-hmm. For example, there's one researcher who studies these crows. And crows actually, despite the fact that their brain is the size of a walnut, turn out to have some abilities that maybe you wouldn't expect them to.
Right.
Now, I hesitate to say they're smarter than you would think or they're more intelligent than you could think, because I'm not sure we have a great understanding of what intelligence is, especially in terms of an animal, but I think they can do some things that you wouldn't expect. For example, so they put the crows in this cage, and in the cage there's a cylindrical tube that has a basket with food at the bottom. Now, the crows can't reach the basket because their head is too big to fit in the cylinder, so they can't get their beak at it. But there's a wire in the room, and the wire's straight. And now in the wild, what the crows would do is they'd use like a long stick to sort of stab into the ground or stab into a piece of wood and then grab out some sort of insect to eat. And so we saw them do that. We actually caught some birds from the wild and then put them in this experimental paradigm and found that what the birds could do is they could take the wire and actually bend it into a hook by pushing it into the ground in order to go and then grab the food out of this cylindrical tube, grab the basket, and get their food. And that was basically like the first thing they could do. And then, I mean, they did all sorts of different paradigms where they would have multi-step procedures, and then they would put them back in and they would change the order of the steps, and the crows could still figure it out. So it seems that these crows have this incredible problem-solving ability. And I guess I read about that and also sort of other types of things we like to learn about animals or want to learn about animals. And my question was, why do we care how good the crow can problem solve? Why is that something that's interesting to us as humans and right. interesting to us as scientists and as spiritualists?
Mm-hmm. And I guess part of what I wonder when you say that is the reason that we're interested in animals to prove something, or is it that we are intrinsically interested in animals and that because of the way that science is conducted right now, that we come up with a reason for doing so, which is to prove things. But then perhaps in that there's also sort of a greater purpose, especially because I think something that you said earlier was that the researchers are people who are interested in the animals not only because of this or perhaps what comes out of it is this wanting to prove something, but they maybe go into it with a different mindset.
Yeah, and I think that's something I wondered the same question that you had kind of just, are we trying to prove something about the animals, or are we just sort of curious about what might be out there?
Right.
And I think what I found in terms of anecdotally profiling the researchers that actually underwent or undertook this entire field of animal experience is that they did so with a deep sort of love and respect at the outset for the animals. And I thought that was really interesting because it seems to me that our default position in terms of animals is that they're not worthy of our interest unless they do something to prove that they are. We can do whatever we want to them until they prove that we shouldn't be doing that to them.
Right. And so this is the case if we look at something like the way that science, like you're saying, the way that science uses animals for research, or even something like the way that we treat animals that we might eat.
Well, and I think that there might be an idea that since we're doing science and science likes to use animals as research subjects, that they must be out there to prove that all the stuff that they do to animals is justified.
Right.
And I think there might be a general idea in science that that's important. But I also think that when you look at the people who actually go out and do that research day in and day out, there was a woman who basically set up a lab to study the linguistic abilities of parrots. And she had she started this in the 70s, and people basically thought she was crazy to try and teach a parrot words, but not just words, but actual language.
Right.
And she could do more than just teach it to repeat things. She could actually teach it to put words together in ways that she would know what it wants. So it could put the words eat and grape together, and she would know that the parrot wanted to eat grapes.
Oh, wow.
And she did so, I think, she did so from the start thinking, I believe there's something here about the parrot that we're missing.
Right, yeah. So then perhaps we most of the time, or perhaps in science at least, and perhaps in spirituality as well, have the sense that animals are not worthy of our thinking of them as being conscious unless we prove that they are. Which seems in some regards to be, to put it bluntly, to be somewhat vain.
Yeah. Well, and gives us an obvious bias sort of from the outset. I mean, because, you know, if you, Davis, want to study the ability, you know, the intelligence of a squirrel, and you can either start believing that squirrel has intelligence and you just need to find... you just need to be the one that can show that it does have intelligence. Mm-hmm. Or you can start out saying, believing there's no way the squirrel has intelligence. And then you do it, if you give it a couple tests and when they all turn negative, then it's sort of like, well, I proved it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think that bias is something that's a problem in science, mm-hmm. especially something like this. But I'm also interested in wondering how sort of our common understandings of animals, if it's the same or different as sort of like a scientific understanding, you know, just someone who's isn't a scientist, you know, maybe is interested in scientists, but maybe is just, you know, I don't know, a plumber or a teacher or whatever, like, you know, who doesn't interact with the scientific method, how they sort of just see animals
Well, I guess I'm not a neuroscientist, but I couldn't necessarily speak to that perspective either. But a perspective that I can speak to is the way that sort of a different kind of science, or what we might call spirituality, practices like yoga or Buddhist meditation work with the investigation of animals. And that's primarily through animal embodiment. So if you think about something like yoga, like maybe one of the first things you think of is downward dog, right? So a lot of what these systems are doing, or something like Qigong, is to embody animals, and through that to sort of investigate what's happening there.
Right.
And that's sort of a reversal of this process of needing to prove that animals are worthy, but that sense of humans being the highest order of consciousness is existent there as well.
Well, I think we're gonna have to get into that after our short break. But I'm interested in sort of understanding the spiritual aspect and how we can maybe relate it to the scientific. But right now, we're gonna go to a couple PSAs.
Tune into the Video Game Music Show, where I play everything from video game music new and old, along with chiptunes, nerdcore, DJ remixes, and cover bands. It's the Video Game Music Show every Friday between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m., only on KSBC 88.7 FM Claremont.
When I grow up, I want to be a new pair of blue jeans.
When I grow up, I want to be a kid's first computer.
When I grow up, I don't want to be a piece of garbage. And if you recycle me, I won't be.
Give your garbage another life. Recycle. Learn how at iwanttoberecycled.org. Brought to you by Keep America Beautiful and the Ad Council.
All right, so we are back on Reality Check, and we just sort of got into we were sort of discussing this, the scientific understanding of animal minds. Now we're going to take a little bit of a look at the spiritual aspect. And Davis, you have like a story that you'd like to read to us.
I do, yeah. So today I was at the farmer's market here in Claremont, California, the beautiful farmer's market, and I came upon a book called Jafta. And on the cover is a little boy who's sort of cuddling with a baby lion cub. And so I was pretty intrigued, knowing that I would be talking about animals and the way humans relate to animals later. So the primary substance of the book is that this young boy, Jafta, relates his different emotions to different animals. So when he feels happy, he does something that he sees animals doing as being happy. Or when he feels strong, he's like a rhino. Or when he feels stubborn, he's like an elephant. But what this sort of made me think about is that he has a sense, either in his body or in his mind, of what sort of emotions animals convey. And I'm seeing this more than something like when we look at a dog and we see its lips pulled back when it's panting as a smile. But this is an actual, real sort of sense of humans that we have animal characteristics in our body. And if we think about the course of evolution, it makes sense, because animals are, in a sense, our ancestors. Even the ones that exist now, we have common ancestors. And so it sort of comes from this primal place within us, and it's all through, I guess, in terms of talking about the way that common people who aren't scientists or spiritualists see this, it's all through our language. You know, like a person was panting like a dog, or you know, someone was
like flying high or something like that.
Yeah, or was excited like a rabbit. Or other ways that we could convey that. But so I think this is an interesting demonstration, especially because it's a kid, of the way that we relate to animals, not only on this sort of more formal level, but on a very primal level, and sort of how they relate to our everyday experience.
And so it seems like from what you were saying before the break, that that was kind of maybe the not the purpose, the sole purpose, but maybe sort of a corollary to doing something like yoga or like Qigong that you mentioned.
Yeah. So part of what I've been learning recently from the mime instructor that I'm studying with is that if you watch people as they walk around, they sort of have these animal embodiments, these characterizations of animals. So someone whose stomach is hanging forward and their back is bent looks a little bit like a cow, whereas someone who's walking with their wrists very bent and their fingers curled in looks like they have cat paws or something like that. But through the practices of yoga and qigong, in which you might embody animal postures, like doing a downward dog, let's say, or a crow pose, or in qigong you might do a dragon drill or an eagle drill, we consciously experience these different animals within our bodies. And sort of, I guess, the quote-unquote purpose of that would be that if we can move through all these states of animal consciousness, we can then be open as possible to experiencing them, but not chained by them in the way that someone who's walking around with their stomach out might be.
And that kind of reminds me, or maybe doesn't remind me, but I think sort of in terms of leading back to our discussion before the break about the science and what the science is trying to prove and the biases that you might come in with before you undertake some kind of scientific study of animals, is that if we sort of are interested innately as humans in embodying kind of animal characteristics, that says to me that maybe we have a responsibility to trust that the animals have characteristics somewhat like us, and that we shouldn't go into it sort of with this kind of idea, well, unless they prove it to us through tests that we design, you know, we're not going to trust them in terms of being anything more than just the machine.
You know, it's funny, the first thing that I think about when you say that is this song that I used to sing in chapel when I was in lower school in Charleston, South Carolina, because I think in all spirituality there's sort of a base principle that all creatures are divine or are in some way connected to God, and thus that we have a connection to all of them. So the song says, all things bright and beautiful, all creatures great and small, all things wise and wonderful, the Lord God made them all. And, you know, it's like there's sort of this, there is this trust that we are all connected in this way. And so then I wonder, in thinking about the science, is somehow that a progression of that trust, and scientists who have this mindset going into it are recognizing more and more that what they're doing is expressing that sort of sense of connection.
I think, well, and at least from what I've read in terms, and like I said, the anecdotes of these people who are interested in studying animals, it does seem like they're coming in with a bias towards the animal having something that we're missing. And I think that's so important in not just science, but in kind of just everyday, you know, making decisions and thinking about how you understand the world. Is the importance of the people who come in with the idea at the outset that we're missing something. Because that's, I mean, I don't think that's a very common view in science, that something like, you know, a crow, especially before the people who studied crows did their research, I'm sure it wasn't a common conception that crows had any sort of intelligent, quote-unquote, abilities. But the people who came in by, and obviously they had some sort of reason to do that. They watched crows in the wild and saw them using tools, for example, not tools that they made, but tools that they found. Without those people who came in with the idea that science was missing something, we might not have ever had that that new addition to kind of our understanding of animal minds.
Right. Yeah. And that's that sense that each person has something to contribute that's sort of missing is certainly essential to spirituality, and I think essential to science. And I guess what it invokes in me is sort of a sense of appreciation and understanding that each person is here in a way to deliver a message. And through the allowing of each person to find their voice, or perhaps the facilitation of that, then we grow richer and richer in our understanding of reality, both through science and through spirituality.
Wow. Yeah, that's really powerful. Unfortunately, we're out of time, and we're going to have to leave it at that. Before we go, like to thank Ann Kirkpatrick, our wonderful sound engineer again, KSPC, all of KSPC. Remember, these are only our opinions, not the opinions of Pomona College or KSPC. If you want to email us, it's kspcrealitycheck@gmail.com. And I think for now, next week, we're going to be coming back to this topic of animals and animal minds, maybe what we can understand about science and the spirit. That is the whole point of the show anyway.
That it is.
So with that, we are going to send it back to Anne. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
This has been The Interchange on KSPC 88.7 FM. My name is Anne Kirkpatrick. Thank you for listening. If you want to revisit tonight's show or any previous episodes, subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or view our archive at interchange887.blogspot.com. You can contact The Interchange through Facebook or Twitter at username interchange887 or email us at publicaffairs@kspc.org with questions, comments, or suggestions. Music from this week's podcast includes Debussy's Clair de Lune, Singing Bowls by Kathleen Page, and Spark Spark by Salam Saeed. Thanks again for listening to The Interchange on KSPC. Stay tuned for The Sound of Pictures with Tom Skelly.